Hello and welcome. We've designed today's session to explore a number of different areas. The biggest challenges, concerns with beginning a net zero journey, the challenges in accessing information and resource, and how you can use technologies to support you. Now, we've got three absolutely fantastic speakers today who I'm delighted to introduce. We've got Juliet Eccleston, who is chair of the CBI's sharing economy. Juliet will be taking us through what the sharing economy is, what it can do, and how it can benefit business. She'll be taking us through the opportunities for business to share operational habits and grow more sustainably whilst also saving money. We've got Lars Ronning, founder and CEO of Aluna. Aluna are a sustainability training app that uses behavioral science to make it fun to develop habits that are good for the planet. And he'll be helping us explore what it takes to build a greener habit, what habits have the most impact, and how do you draw on engagement of sustainability across your organization and business base. And finally, we have Celia Parker Araam, who is Director of Consumer Protection at the CMA. And Celia will be taking us through B2B relations and obligations and SMEs being misled potentially or not, and how to avoid it as a consumer. Not wanting to hear from me when we've got such amazing speakers. Juliet, can I hand over to you to kick us off?
Thanks, Deborah. I'm really glad to be here and be able to represent the sharing economy as part of our CBI relationship. The Sharing Economy UK actually started in 2015 and we became partners with the CBI in 2017 and then joined fully last year. And so we're quite early in our relationship with the CBI, but we're incredibly glad to be at now a fully formed council within the CBI and to be able to really help the growth for all of our members that are part of our council. The sharing economy itself is expected to be worth 140 billion by 2025. And I actually think that's an underestimation, basically, in terms of certainly what we've seen through COVID and the increasing desire for communities and organisations to choose to share more and help to rely on each other more. And so it's really interesting as we begin to reach a different level of maturity of the economy, just exactly how we'll see that running. In terms of the council itself, we support all of our members all the way through from large organisations that people will be very familiar with, such as Airbnb and TaskRabbit, Gumtree and Uber, all the way through to startups and scale-ups. You'll hear from Lars shortly with Aluna and the work that he's doing, which is amazing within the sharing economy. And we have an extraordinary amount of new startups joining us all of the time that are really making the most of this desire for collectively sharing more, utilising resources better. And the way we think of it from a council perspective, because often we get questioned on what is the sharing economy? Is it the gig economy? Is it exactly what is it? And the way that we define it is anything where you're looking to share your space, skills or stuff. So we try and keep it really simple for people to understand that really it's all about better utilization of resources. And with that better utilization of resources, what we're seeing more now is the ability for people to not only consider how they could share more on a peer-to-peer basis or a people-to-people basis, where you're perhaps renting out a room in your house or a seat in your car, or maybe you're borrowing a dog, all of these kinds of things that might be happening between people. Businesses are now becoming much more engaged in the sharing economy. And that's really where we see the excitement all the way through from SMEs through to large corporates and the opportunity for this utilization of better resources will impact not only what we're obviously talking about today around carbon footprint and if organizations are looking to perhaps share office space or share a lorry space or even through their employees sharing more, but also we're looking to see much more in terms of productivity improvements, cost improvements, and also some amazing opportunities for brand new revenue streams as well. And so the interesting thing that, I'd like to really get across to people listening today, whatever size of organization, is that there's an opportunity there for people to start to relook at their operating models and to start to see it through a lens of sharing. And obviously engagement with the sharing economy is something that you can do that. So often what people start to do is have as an organization is have a level of maturity of sharing. And sometimes that can start with something as simple as what food are we not using? Can that be shared externally to our organization? Could our employees begin to car share? What events have we got? How could we better share within that? And so what we're seeing is that as organizations begin to share, then their employees begin to recognize the sharing economy also as a way to share within their own personal lives as well. Obviously, with that becomes comes an awful lot of responsibility in terms of us being clear on exactly what our claims are from a green perspective. And I know Cecilia will be picking up on that. And we're really keen to work with our members to make sure that our platforms can be trusted in the claims that we're making and both in the transactions that people are performing on those platforms as well.
Thank you, Julia. And we will be delving more into what Juliet was just talking through and how actually that practical application, I think, is really important, because it's sometimes hard to think through what can I actually and how can I use the sharing economy. Lars, I'm going to hand over to you, please. And I think we're really keen to hear about habits and good habits that can be fun. Especially in January.
Yeah, so what I'm going to cover is essentially three themes. It's about what does it take to build greener habits, what habits have got the most impact, and also how do you drive engagement. But I think just to set the scene first and explain a little bit about, you know, who we are and what we do. So we founded iLuna a couple of years ago. We launched the app last year. The app is a training app that is helping individuals and businesses build better habits. We ourselves, as we are an SMB, we are a small team, a small distributed team. The UK is our home market, but we've got users now in more than 50 countries. But I think, first of all, in terms of what it takes to build greener habits, it's actually not necessary to believe in or understand climate change to build greener habits. So I think whether you believe in climate change or not, I think we've all come to the realization that we need to take better care of the environment. And that includes air quality, water quality, biodiversity, and just general well-being. So one of the questions we're getting quite often is, does belief drive action or does action drive belief? And most people will say that it's belief that drives action, that you need to believe in something before you change. But it's actually the opposite. So if you take a look at all of the debate we had in 2015 around 5P plastic bags, many people came up with all sorts of reasons for why that would not work. They did not believe in it. But actually, in fact, through action, people saw that it wasn't difficult and that remembering your reusable bag quickly became a habit. But I think something that we as small business owners do need to believe in is our customers. And the reality is that customers these days are increasingly turning to businesses that are sustainable themselves. So if for nothing else, let's believe in our customers and make them believe in you. So the starting point to building greener habits really is action. It is to get started. And in terms of what it takes to build a new habit, it depends on the person and it depends on the habit. So some people pick up new things very quickly, and some new things that are easier to pick up than others. So generally speaking, to build a new habit, you would need a month. But then again, some things can be achieved in a matter of days and others could maybe take as much as a year. And the good news is that some things aren't even a habit, but a swap, such as moving to a greener energy supplier or changing the light bulbs. But to quote James Clear, who wrote Atomic Habits that we are drawing inspiration from, to maximize a chance of success, start with something that is incredibly small, such as remembering your reusable cup or remember your reusable bag when you go shopping, something that is so easy that you don't need motivation to do it, and then keep at it. So daily tiny gains will just have, you know, huge impact. So what we need to focus on is just becoming 1% better every day, not staying where we are or becoming 1% worse every day. So for some of the more difficult habit changes, such as cutting meat out of your diet, what we need to do is change one habit at a time and then break the habits into manageable chunks and then set a goal of doing it a couple of days a week, then a week, rather than trying to set a target of a full month immediately, which for most people can be daunting. And again, also change one habit at a time rather than trying to boil the ocean. So the next question then is which habits have got the most impact? And this is a really interesting one, because there is often a significant difference between what people perceive to have the most impact and what actually does have the most impact. So in one of the recent surveys that we've looked at, 59% of people thought that recycling as much as possible had the greatest impact. But in fact, what has much greater impact is switching to a green energy supplier, not having a car, or moving to electric car, or eating a plant-based diet. Well, actually, the most sustainable thing in the long run is to have one fewer child, but I don't think I'm going to be an advocate for that on this call here. But that is at least what research shows. So the habits that will have the most impact around energy efficiency in terms of heating, electricity, and water. So if you look at the average UK household or small business, as much as 1,600 litres of water is being wasted every week. 75% of electricity consumption comes from appliances when they're turned off because they are on standby. And also turning heat down 1 degree can save 10%. So look at energy efficiency as, I would say, one of the first thing that you as a small business should try to tackle. The second thing to tackle is around transportation, which makes up for 27% of greenhouse emission gases in Europe. So encourage your employees to cycle, run or walk to work, take public transport, avoid flying. And also, and that's something we've learned through COVID, support working from home a few days a week, because that will also help reduce CO2 footprint. Another one, as I mentioned previously, is eating sustainably, which could be the single biggest way to reducing environmental impact on Earth. And that is in many ways more impactful than cutting down on flights or buying an electric vehicle. And to the topic of food, it's not only a matter of reducing food waste, but the thing is also that food that is thrown away is often left to rot instead of being composted, which results in methane that is more damaging to the atmosphere than CO2. So being a small business owner ourselves, we're also looking at plastic and packaging, of course. So there it's really important to embrace the circular economy around reducing, reusing, and recycling. So first of all, looking at where can we reduce, don't buying things that we don't need, buy secondhand. And when you buy something, make sure that you buy something that is made from recycled materials. Maybe look at Ellen MacArthur Foundation, watch Ellen's videos, and that will give a really good insight into how the circular economy works and why we should support it. And also, again, as small business owners, we should do business with other green businesses and thereby, you know, getting the snowball rolling and having impact across the business space. Looking at infrastructure, use green hosting, do an IT audit. There is a company called Whole Grain Digital that has created a website carbon calculator where you can easily go onto the website and you can actually that way see how green your website is. And that's a good way to start looking at your infrastructure to make it more sustainable. And then finally, we are not going to get to net zero overnight. So we all need to also buy carbon offsets for whatever we cannot reduce through changes in our business. And that will help move the needle towards carbon neutrality. And there are quite a few companies out there offering carbon offsets. How do you then draw engagement on sustainability across your organization or your business base? Well, first of all, this needs to be supported from the top of the organization, but that shouldn't be too hard these days since the business world is moving that way. 96% of business leaders understand today also that without employee engagement, things won't change. And good news for the UK is becoming a leader in sustainability. So in terms of driving change around the business, it's important that we change together. It makes it so much easier and more fun when you're not alone. So make sure you involve your colleagues, your partners, your customers, everybody else in changing. Share your experience, share your tips and tricks, and turn it into a game or friendly contest to change. And what I'd also say is make it public what you're doing. Set some targets and some goals that are achievable. They need to be achievable, and then tell the world about them. And you'll quickly see that this turns into support amongst your employees, your business partners, and customers. Put it on your website. Use social media to spread the word. And maybe as a source of inspiration, you could take a look at Go Cardless. They're posting on LinkedIn in terms of what they do. And I find what they could do quite inspirational. What you could also do is working with passionate change makers. There are a number of organizations out there that can help with kickoff sessions for your team. I would suggest joining the SME Climate Hub, which is a partner of UN's Race to Zero initiative. And if you go to their website and you sign up, you'll find loads of tools and inspiration there that will help us all. Of course, I'd love you to download iLuna, that goes without saying. But in summary, what I'd say is just using a famous quote, just do it. It's good for the environment, it's good for personal health, and it's good for business health. They were a few words about sustainability, and hope this was helpful. Back to you, Deborah.
Thank you, Lars. And in just on the sort of plant-based diet, I am going to give a bit of a shout out to sustainable farmers who do a fantastic job in terms of keeping the ecosystem going. So if anyone is ever interested, I would say Launceston, you have the Cornwall Project and also Piper's Farm. Amazing sustainable farmers who do a lot of regeneration. Right, Cecilia, over to you.
Thanks. Well, I don't feel great following Lars because that was very inspirational, and I feel like now it's down to earth a little bit of a bump. But I'll maybe start just with a little story. So right back at the beginning of lockdown, I was fortunate enough, given my caffeine habit, that my local coffee caravan in the local park remained open. And so I decided, since I was working from home, I was going to have a daily commute, walk around the park and pick up my coffee. Because of the hygiene situation, I was told I could no longer bring my keep cup to use. And the guy that runs the stall, he would make sure that he was offering biodegradable, compostable cups. That was great. He wasn't charging me any extra for it. And he was, you know, doing his bit to make me feel less guilty about the fact that I couldn't use my keep cup. Unfortunately, in Edinburgh, the only thing that you can do with biodegradable, compostable cups is put them in the rubbish, because we don't do industrial composting and the cups are not suitable to go in food waste. And so he, as a business owner, was spending his valuable money buying those cups, probably at greater expense than regular cups, because he thought he was doing the right thing. And that's one of the things that really the work the CMA is looking at, is trying to combat. So we, as some of you might be aware, I hope you're aware, in September this year, published some new guidance. Now, that guidance is predominantly aimed at businesses who are marketing to consumers, and it sets out six principles for marketing your products. You have to be truthful and accurate in what you're saying. You have to be clear and unambiguous. You can't omit or hide important information. Any comparisons you're making need to be fair and meaningful. You have to consider the full life cycle of a product, and any claims that you're making should be evidence-based. Now, we'll come on and say a little bit more about the B2B side of things in a moment, but just for those of you that are retailing to consumers, I wanted to highlight a couple of aspects of those principles. Some of them are, none of them are rocket science, so I don't need to go into too much detail about things like truthful and accurate and clear and unambiguous, but I wanted to pick up just on the point about emissions, because that's one where we've had a lot of questions. So I think the key thing is that when you are marketing to consumers and you're making green claims is to make sure that you're not hiding or leaving out information that a consumer needs to make an informed decision. Now, obviously, depending on the product, that will affect what the consumer actually needs to make an informed decision. And for businesses, I guess one of the most likely scenarios and where you might need to think about this is where you're making claims about one aspect of a product and you're hiding other aspects. And so, for example, we have heard anecdotally that there are some businesses who claim to make products out of recycled plastic bottles. And the particular person that told us this explained that in some cases, while yes, the clothing is made out of recycled plastic bottles, the bottles themselves have never been used. So they're not taking post-consumer waste, they're taking bottles, they're recycling them into clothing, clearly there are all sorts of things wrong with that. And so that's the kind of thing where you might be omitting really crucial information. Another thing, and I was interested to hear Lars touching on offsetting, you might be telling your customers that their deliveries are carbon neutral, but you need to be explaining how you are achieving that. Are you doing that because you are paying your local bicycle cooperative to cycle around the city and deliver groceries or stuff from your zero waste store, as I'm lucky enough to have in Edinburgh, or are you offsetting? And if so, what offsetting scheme are you used? Because unfortunately, not all offsetting schemes are created equal. And the other thing I just want to touch on is the idea that you have to consider the full life cycle, because I know that's one that has exercised a lot of people. Now, right now in the UK, there is no obligation in most circumstances to do a life cycle assessment. And we know actually for some businesses, for some products, it's really challenging to do an accurate life cycle assessment. But the reason we ask you to consider the life cycle is because you need to make sure that the claims that you are presenting are overall not misleading. And again, this is a bit similar to the idea of emissions. So if we go back to thinking about the coffee cup, if you are presenting something as biodegradable and compostable, yes, that is an accurate statement. Probably the coffee cup is genuinely biodegradable, genuinely compostable. But if you are presenting that without giving information to consumers that they are probably not going to be able to compost or biodegrade that coffee cup in the circumstances available in their local community, then that's a case where you are misleading, because you're not taking into account that sort of that wider life cycle point. And there've been a couple of really interesting international cases on this in the last few weeks, one in Canada that was connected with so-called recyclable coffee pods, another in New Zealand, which was recyclable single-use coffee cups. In both cases, neither could be recycled in the communities in Canada and New Zealand. And so the competition and consumer protection authorities there concluded that that wasn't good enough and that they were misleading customers. So I'd come back and touch on the issues about retailers. Now, one of the things that we made clear in the guidance is that as retailers, you can be liable for the claims that are made on the products you are selling. So it is really important that to the best of your ability, you are doing what you can to check the veracity of the claims on the products that you are selling. But that said, we know particularly for SMEs, there are challenges in getting that information. We know there are businesses up the supply chain that are reluctant to share that information. And so there's a couple of things I just wanted to sort of make you aware of, not to let you off the hook, but to kind of reassure you that you're not automatically going to end up in any trouble. The first thing is that there is a set of regulations in the UK, the Business Protection for Misleading Marketing regulations, which do what they say on the tin. The idea is that they will protect you from misleading marketing. So if another business is selling something to you on the basis that it is recyclable or some other way sustainable, and they are misleading you, they are not telling you the truth about what is happening, then they may well be in breach of the Business Protection for Misleading Marketing regulations. That also covers comparisons. So if a business is comparing their product to yours, perhaps suggesting that it's more eco-friendly or more sustainable, has a lower carbon footprint, and then their comparisons have to be fair. So they have to be able to demonstrate that they are using similar metrics and that they're really being fair in their comparison. The other thing is a more practical point from the CMA. So we try to target our enforcement in a way that is proportionate and that has the greatest impact for the least amount of resource. And that means that, generally speaking, we will focus our attention at the place where we can make the biggest impact. So if you're a small business selling a product that is made by a supplier, upchain supplier, who's supplying to lots of small businesses, the chances are we are going to be more interested. We might want to come and talk to you. We might want to get evidence from you. But the chances are we are going to be more interested in tackling the behavior of that upstream supplier, because then that cascades down. And just to finish up, just a couple more points. You may have heard we announced on Friday that fashion retail is going to be our first area of focus. So you may be an SME in the fashion retail sector, and we'd be very happy to talk to you about what we're doing in that space. And we are predominantly looking at primary retailers at the moment. We're not going to look at the secondary market for fashion at this stage. The other thing that we're doing is we're currently working on some advice to government. And it's due to be published probably towards the end of January or into early February. There are a few different aspects of what we'll be suggesting to government that they need to consider. One of them is around environmental information requirements. And we've heard a lot about the challenges that a lack of standardized definitions and a lack of standardized metrics is creating for businesses. So we'll be encouraging government to go and think about what could be done to ensure that there is standardization of that information. And the other area is around, or another area is around supply chain transparency. So encouraging the government to consider what they can do in terms of supply chain transparency to try and ensure that businesses, and particularly businesses further down the supply chain, are able to get the information they need in order to inform consumers properly.
And I think there's a couple of things I'm really keen to come back on to from yours, your talk, Cecilia, and Lars, yours as well. I mean, I think there's that piece around the offsetting, and, you know, offsetters aren't all equal. Cool. How does an SME navigate that? How can they find best practice in that field? If, you know, they've not been able to do some of the activities that Lars talked about, and they are at that point as actually, we've got to do offsetting. How do they ensure that they get the best in class?
Yeah, no, I think I can cover some of that at least. So one of the things I would say is that it's important to go to an established organization that is doing their due diligence when it comes to picking sustainability projects to support through offsetting. So you could work with somebody like Ecology, for example. They will be working with organizations like Gold Standard or Verra that are certifying sustainability projects around the world. And even then, I would say that an SMB should take a look at the projects that they intend to support, and also from an ethics perspective, from a branding perspective, that it also goes hand in hand with what the business is trying to achieve. But yeah, there are organizations out there that are certifying projects, and I would go to one of those, even though there is some debate around some of them, but it's a good place to start.
I think Lars is much more of an expert on this than I am. I mean, I would say with anything, is it's about doing the research. And, you know, I always think that any of us, either as consumers or as businesses, we should approach what we're told with a healthy dose of skepticism, not to distrust everything we hear, but I suppose skepticism in the true scientific meaning, ask the questions, check what information is there to support what's being said, and perhaps be more cynical if the information isn't forthcoming, if information isn't easy to find, because that would suggest that there's something worth hiding.
And I want to touch on the issue of sort of supply chains. And Julia, I'm keen to come to you on that. But before that, Cecilia, you talked about recycling. In fact, you all talked about recycling. You know, I mean, I'm very personally very passionate about taking decision making at the lowest possible level. But recycling, I don't know, it seems like it's very difficult if you're a business that operates across, you know, boundaries, district council, county council, doing different things. Have you got any advice? You know, and Cecilia, you talked about your coffee cup, but if you lived in a different geography, that could be compostable. Have you got any advice for businesses that are actually just operating in an area where the local authority isn't at the standards that they would want to be at in terms of recycling?
The challenge is that, you know, you're working and we don't want to be penalising businesses who are working in a local authority and discouraging businesses who are working in a local authority that isn't pulling its weight. But the reality is that you have to work with the circumstances you have. And I would say in those cases, you probably want to avoid suggesting that things are recyclable, or make it clear to customers that although you would like to be able to recycle these things, right now you can't. And perhaps encourage your customers and encourage other businesses to lobby the council to change things. I'm fortunate enough to live in Scotland, where Zero Waste Scotland have done a fantastic job of galvanising local authorities to standardise the approach that they are taking. I'm unfortunate enough to live in Edinburgh, where it's the one, I believe, council that has not signed up to Zero Waste Scotland's principles, or at least they hadn't the last time I checked. But you know, using those opportunities to pressure your local authority to focus on what matters, I think, is a powerful thing.
Julia, perhaps I can come to you in terms of the supply chain piece. It's a pretty gnarly one for many SMEs. Can you talk us through, you know, how SMEs can influence and their supply chains and their net zero, and actually get the data that they are needing from the supply chains to be able to talk through their net zero practices and the challenges that they might be facing and how possibly to overcome them?
Yeah, I mean, and I think this is, you know, really from me speaking to an awful lot of the businesses within our council, really, and because one of the things that we have to be very conscious of when we're making our own claims around sharing is that actually any knock-on impacts of the things that we do or our own supply chains don't then have a detrimental impact on the broader outcome that we're trying to look for. And I think one of the interesting things that I'm seeing much more, and it's happening in this conversation actually, are words around transparency and due diligence, which haven't really come up from a carbon footprint perspective as much. You often see those words around financials or the contents of products that you might be bringing into a store if it's retail, or in terms of transportation, you know, you might be looking at that, or you might be looking at employment status as a thing that you want to investigate. But actually now I think it's time for that due diligence to include carbon emissions and the impact on the environment. It may well also include, as Lars mentioned, what your ethical beliefs are from a retailer perspective or a small business perspective, and begin to procure items, or and not just, I guess, in your supply chain, but your whole operating model in terms of who do you engage with as on a supplier basis for all of the aspects of your organization, and asking the same level of information and data as you would do on everything else. So if you're engaging with a technology supplier for a new system, then what are their own what is their own understanding of carbon footprint? How is that going to influence what they're going to help you to implement within your own business? And to really ask the same level of information as you would do for all of the other aspects within a procurement cycle. And really where you know, all of the kind of information that Cecilia has gone through in terms of the kinds of things that they would expect in terms of what are you comparing yourself to, and is that fair, and is that open? Where are you getting your own data from as a supplier? And so asking those questions and including it within your due diligence. And then obviously if things do happen later on down the line, then you've got all of that data as well from an audit perspective to be able to fall back on should you need it. But I think the more as organizations we do that within our own supply chain, the more those that are supplying will expect that data to need to be provided as well.
Yes, I think that's a really good point, is those that you're supplying, and we know from some of the, you know, larger members in CBI membership that is absolutely, you know, front and centre stage on their agenda, and the requirements for their supply chain are getting very high up the agenda. Perhaps we can just sort of touch on the ESG point before we sort of round off, and perhaps I can come to each of you in turn. Why should SMEs care about ESG? And, you know, how do they get started? It's a term that we hear bandied around a lot. And there's different models and different ways of doing it. But so how do you get started?
Yeah, I think the important thing is not to overthink it, really, because you can spend a long time doing research and setting targets and goals. And it just means that it'll take a long time for you to actually get started. So I would say be practical. Just get started, and along the way, you will be able to set some of those targets because you will be more educated once you've gone on the journey. So that's what I would say. And then what I would also do, as I mentioned previously, I would sign up for something like the SME Climate Hub that is part of UN's Race to Zero, because that's a great way to draw inspiration, to get tools that you would need to get started. But yeah, don't overthink it. It doesn't have to be complicated.
Thank you. Juliet?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some massive reasons to do it. Obviously, there's the broader picture in terms of the environment, but actually a lot of reasons are around the fact that your consumers yes. are wanting that. And so I think in terms of the messaging, there's a massive opportunity for you to go there first, you know, potentially compared to your competitors and differentiate yourself in that way. I also think there's an opportunity for some of those organizations that perhaps have employees to use it as a way to engage employees in conversations and have that as something that you talk about with people that you're working with in terms of what shall we do first? What is, you know, where, you know, the 1% that Lars was talking about, what is our 1%? What does that look like? What shall we do today that we weren't doing yesterday? And begin to have those conversations and start to change as an organization over time rather than it being a big step. One of the things we talk about we talk to an awful lot of very traditional organizations about how to bring in sharing models within their organization. And we talk about this maturity model, but it always starts just with having conversations with those that are in your organization first to see where everybody is and what is everybody already doing, and then where can you go from there?
Cecilia.
So I would say, I mean, I think great points from Lars and Juliet. I mean, one thing I think is to be honest about the journey. I mean, obviously, a lot of businesses are starting to tell their customers what they are trying to do for sustainability. As Juliet said, you know, customers are demanding that. But actually, some of what we're seeing is businesses paying lip service to sustainability. They might have a sustainability statement. They might focus on a couple of very narrow issues and try to mask the fact that they're not getting everything right. We're starting to see some businesses take the complete opposite approach, and we, you know, you hear marketing companies now talking about radical transparency. There's a few businesses that are kind of adopting that approach of saying, look, we're on a journey, we're not ever getting everything right, we're trying really hard here. And actually that's great for a couple of reasons. One, you're much less likely to fall foul of a regulator coming and knocking your door down because you're not painting the full picture. But actually, particularly millennials and Gen Z seem to really appreciate that sort of radical transparency, and they will trust a business more that is being honest about the things that it is not yet getting right. So that's what I would say. Try and tell people as much as you can about the journey that you're on.
Thank you, Celia. It's about that authenticity, isn't it? Sorry, Lars. Sorry.
Yeah, and maybe considering becoming a B Corp. I mean, becoming a B Corp means that you will have to go through all of your own processes, your supply chain relationships, and that will force you step by step to become a sustainable business yourself. So that would be an interesting route for many small businesses to take, I think.
So thank you very much, Juliet, Cecilia and Lars. Perhaps Lars, if I can use one of your quotes to round us off, is just get started, as just get started. So thank you so much for joining us, everyone. We'll look forward to seeing and hearing from you in a month's time. Take care, everyone, and happy 2022.